His wife goes out and owes money all over town, and they pee on my rug?
They pee on your fucking rug?
They peed on my fucking rug.
That's right, dude. They peed on your fucking rug.
Welcome back, and I'm back from Adepticon. Let's see. Had a great time. Did all 4 days. Didn't do everything I wanted to, but I feel quite content. I spent money on food. I ate a lot. I spent a lot. I saw a lot. That's all that matters, right? Went with my wife and a friend of mine, Jeff. Let's see. Got some games in, of course. I played the Malifaux Story Encounter, which I'll get to that in a second here. Enforcer Battle, I did that. And Henchman Hardcore, I did that. I didn't play Masters or nothing because I took a Riva with me this year. And it will be the first time that I actually played Riva. So, and that's that. Well, in today's episode, we have interview with Graham McNeil. Kind of botched up a little bit, but it's up there. I didn't get C.L. Werner because just stuff came about and the scheduling and stuff. It was just, I might have to do Skype with him. Got my book signed, though, so that's kind of cool. Let's see. Interview with Graham. That went really well. Played a little couple demo games. Like I said, saw a lot. Bought a lot from the Weird Booth. And that takes me to my Adepticon giveaway. I had the limited edition Lazarus model. I'm going to put it up for grabs. And all I'm looking for is you send me your email at seanhammer9@yahoo.com. Tell me what the best... your favorite part of this episode, I guess, was and what you thought I did or didn't do at Adepticon that I should have. So, and you give me that email before we get in the next podcast. I'll see who we have for a winner. Also, unfortunately, a friend of mine died first day of Adepticon. He wasn't with us, but he did die from brain cancer. And heart goes out to his family and such. And I'm going to miss him. I mean, he's a good guy. His name was Matt Woodard. He died from brain cancer. Me and a couple of my friends are putting together the Wild Ones box set. We're going to paint it, put it up for auction, and give the proceeds to his family after it sells on auction. So keep your eye out on my Facebook page and also on the Sean Hammer page. And as soon as we get that posted up with the link, I'll go ahead and let everyone know. I'm sure it's going to be beautiful because Derek's painting it, and he painted my, I call it the Crazy Cat Lady. But, you know, the Hamlin crew that we'll be covering over today. Really nice job. So, to that, we'll, you know, give, you know, we'll miss you, Matt. And, yeah, I don't know what else to say. I'm not good with this. So, let's move on. Let's see, we drove this year. It was a pretty cool drive. About 5.5 hours. Not too bad. Hotel stay was decent. Adepticon itself was pretty cool. Yeah, I had money. I spent money. I did not catch up with the guys from the Life After the Cover save. Well, I didn't know they were going to be there, and I didn't see the Star Wars room. I saw a lot of stuff that I did like. Got some scenery for a bayou table, so I got a mat and some swamp puddles, I guess, and a whole bunch of buildings that my daughter put together. And I picked up the TT Combat, hotel, so this is a nice big western looking building for my Malifaux table, so that's good. Let's see, you say, what did I buy? Well, first of all, I took Riva, and I'm just going to go over the crew list I played with her. Just give me 1 second here. I took her, I had her painted, and I wanted a new crew. I also took Ulix. Just in case I didn't feel like Riva at the last minute. But I ended up staying playing with Riva for the storyline. And did Gracie for the hardcore henchman or the henchman encounter. And I did Old Major for the hardcore henchman. Well, my Riva crew is this. I took Riva, Riders in the Sky Upgrade, Bloodmark, and the Guise of Death. Three Shield Bearers, two Draugrs. I took Vincent, and I took his upgrade, and I took Decaying Aura. I didn't do too bad, and I'll get to how I went with everything. after talking with everyone and after seeing how she plays, I'm definitely positively think I'm going to pick up my new purchase, which was Asura Rotten. She's another henchman. I think she'll theme well with Reva. She drops mindless zombies, and they count as corpse counters, so Reva can do stuff through corpse counters and also through those corpse candles, so I should be having lots of undead fun later on. But I'll go through and I'll let you know exactly how that worked out in the future. But, let's see. Everything is not eventful too much. The henchman hardcore was okay. I did well. The enforcer battle ended up being five people against Sean because I played Gracie with Dirty Cheater. And I kill something, I die. I kill something, I die. I take first blood, I die. And she was handling her own, but she was staying alive, and it took a couple people at a time to go ahead and whack her down to size. So, but most importantly, it was fun. As for the story encounter, today's episode outside the Graham McNeil interview is going to be cat-centric because I'm going over the cat on crew. I know we did Hamlin a while ago, but my experience level and stuff got up, and I'm pretty excited because of the new crew and everything, so my new painted kitties. Let's see. Story encounter was three rounds using the Giddings Grounds 2018. Had a little bit of a rough time trying to figure out what schemes or how I was going to take them because I never saw them before. I forgot to download the pack before I went. And how they interacted with the scenarios for each round. The first round was you pick two schemes. And the strategy was actually herding your cats. Basically, you and your opponent got a 50-millimeter cat trolley, I guess. And it goes on the opponent's side of the board and vice versa within 10 inches of the center line. Well, 5 inches each side. And you got four, you set up two cats, each of you two cats. And your goal is to go up to the cat, make a willpower test against it to see if you control the cat. If you control the cat can move 5 inches. And you want to go ahead and push the cats to the middle there, where your booth is. And during the initiative flip after, you flip a card and the cats could get unruly, become harder to control. Just a couple little things. So it's pretty neat. Straightforward, you don't want to push them up on the first turn to the cat cart because they won't count the next turn. They can't count two turns in a row if they're up to there. So get maxed out of your schemes. You got to like belly flop them and stuff. I played a Gremlin player that match. Ended up being okay. Guy was great. His name was Flint. Had a great game. I come out mildly behind. But it is what it is. Second match was this cat food thing. And I played against a guy. I forgot his name. I like suck so bad. But I have pictures on my Facebook page if you want to see these. He played a Leviticus crew. That was horsemen. The horseman list. It seemed like a lot to handle. Me playing my crew the first time and getting to learn it, and I think this kid just got a whole ahead of himself. I'm not saying he's cheating, but he could have slowed down. Of course, everyone knows you're in time limit in these Malifaux tournaments, so it gets pretty hectic. But I lost that one, and not entirely too bad. But what happened there is you had your schemes from getting ground. But the strategy was you had four cat markers on the board. And your job was to go up to an opponent and throw cat food on him. If you threw cat food on him, you got a point. Now, each model, the one with the highest amount of cat food on him, the cats moved 7 inches that way, and they would attack. And they got two attacks. So they move seven. They're unimpeded, so they move. It's not considered a charge or anything that you get bonuses for charges or nothing. You don't get it. I lost a Draugr that day. Seriously, two cats just ate him up, and I just couldn't believe it. It's a sad, sad day when a little kitten, Joker, Red Flips, I was just like, you know, I was like, Jesus, really? But that one I did lose. There was a lot going on the board with that one. I could have stayed a little bit more focused on the schemes. Like most of the storyline events, the strategies are kind of wonky. If they work, they work. Oh, we had corner deployment on that, too, and that was a I didn't like that. Didn't like that for that one at all. Now, the last match, I ended up playing a gentleman, which I forgot his name too. I'm horrible. Got him up. But he played Lady Justice. Basically, what was happening here is you had to go through and you had to kill models. And you got, basically, blood tokens and stuff. Anyone who did severe damage got points, and they could trade them in for fast and stuff like that. Well, ultimately, and the end of things, the point of it was to summon, not Killjoy, but Catjoy. So you're summoning a big old model that was like Killjoy that would attack people and stuff like that, and you got your victory points for that and everything. I won that game, and for some odd reason, it was close deployment. I thought, shit, I'm so gonna get screwed up. But, wow, I damn near tabled the guy. And I was just like, fluke, I don't know, maybe it just started coming to me, you know, everything what's in it. I really think Lady J is a hard crew to take on. I mean, I play Lady J, I know she's got a lot of tricks and stuff, and I just love being thrown in that box, too, let me just tell you. So that was a storyline event for that. I won Best Painting one day, got some brushes for my Reaver crew, so that was pretty cool. Now, like I said, I just mainly gawked around like a child, did some paint and takes at the Reaper booth, hit the weird booth a whole bunch of times, picking up stuff for myself, my buddy Derek, Brandon, and of course for the for the auction for Matt. And that's about it. It was just leisure. No, the only thing I had scheduled was just those times on the events I was going at. I would have liked to get more games of Malifaux with some people. And I would have liked to play Jeff and Tanya while we were there too. But we'll get it in soon. Let's see. I'm going to stop right there. I'm going to go ahead and put in the Graham McNeil interview. Right after that, I'll go over the Cat Lady, touch on some stuff. I'll geek about it, and hopefully I'll be able to get some pictures on the website about it. If not, go to my Facebook page. Just Facebook and look up Sean Hammer. And if I'll put a link into the show from it too. And I'll try and put some pictures as well. I'm quite proud. I'm happy to have it. Okay, so take a quick break, interview with Graham McNeil, and then I'll be back to finish this one.
Mechanicum, False Gods, those sort of things. But
be fun
also,
my friend Jason will tell us about it. Because,
books,
why would anyone waste their time writing about the Ultramarines?
Or
but,
the Sigmar novels.
But anyway, a lot of them I've read and everything. Out of all of your works,
now,
what
I know,
genre is your
I know
favorite
the Ultramarines
because
the
I made fun of my friend Jason Justice about it. Because why would anyone waste their time writing about the Ultramarines?
You know, your favorite book is the one I'm writing.
But anyway, a lot of them I've read and everything. Out of all of your works, what genre is your favorite that you write about for the Black Library?
I think each one is the favorite when you're writing it. You know, my favorite book is the one I'm writing right now, kind of thing. But you got to have some variation, some variety in the things you're doing. Because I love 40K, but you can only write so many 40K novels in a row before, you know, you want to write something fantasy with, you know, something with an orc and an axe and all sorts of, you know, magic and things like that. So it varies depending on how much you've been involved in one or the other, which one's a favorite at that particular moment. But I love writing fantasy, you know, because that's the closest one to my heart. That's why I grew up reading, and I love writing, you know, heroic fantasy in the vein of, you know, David Gemmell and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Speaking of fantasy, when you're writing the Sigmar books, did perhaps maybe your upbringing in your native land, you know, and play any part in your writing on those books?
Without a doubt. Like I say, I'm from, my family is from the Highlands of Scotland, so that rugged landscape, that, you know, primal setting for the story was rooted firmly in the Highlands of Scotland. I mean, a lot of the storytelling and the legends and the mythology that come out of a land and a country are shaped by its geography, and a lot of Scottish mythology comes out of the grim moors, the dark valleys and all that sort of stuff, and tonally that played a huge part in how I told the Sigmar novels, because the Empire is that place of dark, thick and penetrable forests, you know, villages as these tiny islands of civilization cut off. You know, and when the darkness comes, you bolt the doors and you stay inside.
It's kind of like last year's election. But some would say I'm impartial, so it doesn't matter. Now, I know a lot of my listeners love the Horus Heresy novels, and I know a lot of them have read Age of Sigmar as well. The big pull of those novels, really, is to see that beyond life character, maybe like the Primarch of something, or actually Sigmar himself, how is it writing and developing, you know, detailing out a character that it's got a little bit of mythos already set into it, and everyone has their own idea how that character should represent. How do you handle that, whether you're writing your own way, like, say, with Magnus?
Well, I mean, with any character that you write in the Heresy, if they're a big name, they've existed somewhere already. You know, they've in the codexes, the army books, whatever. You always have to keep that in mind, because you know, the cardinal rule of any character you're writing, if they've appeared somewhere else in either another author's novel or in a background book or whatever, is don't break it. You know, it's not your toy. You're just borrowing it. You know, you've got to be respectful of what's been before. You can absolutely add your own interpretations, your own layers to things, but don't break it. Fundamentally, this is a character who people like and enjoy, and they understand them and they know them. And if you mess with that too much, they're going to push back on that, because this is not character A or character B, who I know and love. And you can challenge that. You can add new wrinkles to it. You can go deeper into them and add or discover new things along the way, but if fundamentally you break them, people won't like that, and I don't like that, and I don't want to do that. You know, I want people to recognize that my Magnus is Magnus, that if I borrow somebody else's character to put in my book, then it still feels that character, that I haven't done a disservice to that writer's work.
In some of the works, like, say, Prosper Burns and The Thousand Sun, how was it writing one half of a story and letting another author show the side of that? Was there any collaboration between the both of you to make sure things crossed evenly? And was it fun?
It was possibly the most fun I've ever had writing a book. Dan and I worked very closely in the early stages of those two books to try and figure out where the points of crossover were, where the points of connection, where the points of divergence should be. We spoke to each other a lot during the process, and my book certainly is by far the better for having collaborated with Dan, because there were ideas that we had, ideas that came out in the book that were sparking off the conversations we had that I would never have had on my own. You know, I hope Dan feels the same way, that Prospero Burns benefited from the conversations we had. I know I got a great deal out of working with Dan. We achieved a lot by working together that we wouldn't have done alone, and it was tremendous fun. Yeah, tremendous fun.
Well, this goes out to the 40K hardcore players. We have 30K and 40K. Is there a difference, and which one do you like writing more about?
There's absolutely a difference. 30K, not so much, as we go deeper into it, it's not so much the optimistic vision that the opening books had, where this was the characters were a hair's breadth from succeeding and getting the very thing that they'd spent years fighting for. 30K should, for me, is like, if I'm reading a book, or the reader should be able to tell, even if they haven't seen the cover or the title, they should know by the tone of the words, the style of the language, that they're reading a Heresy book. You know from the get-go tonally that you're in for something different, whether you read one or the other, and so on. And as far, you know, they both elicit different emotions for me when I'm writing them. You know, 30K I write in the knowledge of all that could have been. You know, that this is a tragedy we're writing. This is like our version of Paradise Lost. This is the fall of the Imperium, from a moment of what could have been glory to the stagnation and horror that is 41st millennium. So I love the 30K ones for that level of drama and tragedy.
Yeah.
I love 40K books because I love horror. As a genre, I love to write and read. And the 40K novels, 40K setting for me, is horror. You know, it's this stagnation of something that could have been brilliant and has ended up as a nightmare.
Yeah, well, they go through hell to get from place to place, really.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, as for the inspiring writers out there, how hard is it to get into being an author, and what can you tell them to look forward to financially, the hurdles they'll get until they've acquired that place they need to be?
Well, you know, being an author is, it's hard work. A lot, you know, I mean, I speak to a lot of people who tell me they would like to be an author and like to write stories, and I ask them, well, what have you written? Well, I've written 10 beginnings and so on. So, have you finished anything yet? No. One of the biggest things that separates, you know, somebody who wants to write and somebody who does write is that they write. You know, they write every day, even if it's just for 5 minutes or 10 words. They finish things. Determination is the thing, the quality I would say most writers have in abundance, because a novel is a slog. It's a 3-month marathon you're running. If you're writing it on the schedules that we often write to, it's a 3 to 4 month marathon of work every day, getting your ass in the chair and putting words on the page. So it's hard work. It's incredibly rewarding work. If you're lucky enough to hit a mother load, then yeah, you can do very well at it. And I am fully aware how fortunate I have been to be working with the Black Library, that I've been able to forge a career and a living out of this that supports me and my family. That is not often the case with a lot of writers. Most writers have full-time jobs. You know, most writers, if they relied solely on their writing income, would be very poor, you know, and I that's not any reflection of their work. That's just a reflection of the reality of the publishing business these days. But write, read. You know, the best writers, the best readers, you know. Know your genre, know your readers, know your IP. Be evocative, be good, learn your craft. Know that your craft is something that needs to be practiced, needs to be learned. You know, nobody starts being writing unless they're very lucky and is brilliant straight out the gate. You know, most people's first efforts are poor, and you know, and I fully hold my hand up to that too. You know, I still keep the first piece of writing I ever did that has, there's more red ink on the page than black ink from the editor's notes. It was a shocking, awful piece of work.
Did it make your stomach turn?
You know, it was like a gut punch. You know, like when you, you know, to borrow a quote from Nick Abnett, you know, when you're writing, you're opening a vein and bleeding in the page. There's something of you goes into everything you write, and you know, to put that out in front of people is a difficult thing, and not everybody can do it. So be prepared for that. Put your work out there, get it written, submit it, keep submitting all the time, keep soliciting feedback, learn from all the feedback you get. Even feedback that says this sucks is a learning opportunity. You know, you're not going to learn much from it, but yeah, this sucks because ABC is hard to hear. It's never easy to hear people critiquing your work like that. But if you can develop a skin enough that you go, you know what, yeah, you're right, that was sucky, and it sucked because of this, that, and that, and I will not do that again, and I will learn from that. That's the thing you want to be doing. Always be learning, always be soliciting feedback all the time.
I know that's difficult. I, a few years back, tried drawing comics, and I thought it was pretty good. And, well, when you take your pictures to these comic book artists, and they're signing comic books, and they're going to circle, just like the red ink on your drawings, and that made me realize, wow, it's not as good as I was. I was definitely the big fish in the little pond in my area and stuff.
Sure.
Now, when did it hit you? I mean, were you like playing video games and a dream? I mean, did you meet somebody? Who turned you on to actually say, hey, you know what? I'm going to start writing.
I mean, I grew up in a house that was filled with books and reading. So the notion that that's just what you did was just always with me. You know, I've always, from the earliest I can remember, had books and comics around me, and I've read all the time. You know, my mother tells a story that I don't remember this because I was too young, obviously, but she was, I was young enough to be strapped in the car seat in the back of a car, and my mum was strapping me in, and I turned to her and said, Mother, when I grow up, I'm either going to be a bin man or a writer. And she's like, oh, okay, sure, I hope it's a writer, or, you know, whatever. But I, I've, I've always told stories and written stories down. I never really thought to do anything other than that as a little bit of a daft wee hobby on the side. But I read a couple of fantasy novels that I loved. Just blew me away. They were so good. And then when I got this same author had done another book, and I read that, and I thought, oh, that's not very good at all. Man, I could do better than that. And that was a real light bulb moment for me of like, okay, if you think you could do better than that, put your money where your mouth is.
Yeah.
Write a book. So it was like that thought was churning away in my head. And I read some books by David Gemmell, a British fantasy author whose work has colossally inspired and shaped me over the years. So, and reading his books just made me want to tell stories like that. I wanted to write books that were as affecting as that, because beforehand all the fantasy I'd read was very, very high fantasy, you know, kings and queens and stuff like this. His books were the forgotten foot soldier, the mud, the blood, the guy who's not the hero but was forced into that role and had to become that guy. And I loved his books. They were, you know, formative in so many ways to me. So the two of those impulses collided, like, okay, I want to write books like this, and God, I think I could do better than that. Okay, let's do this. Okay, let's see what we can do. And, you know, when I was at university, I wrote a 40K novel when I was at university, which, you know, goes some way to explaining why I'm not an architect at this point. And it was terrible. It was awful. It was really, really bad. But I learned a ton by doing it, and I gave it to everybody I could think of that might have a tiniest bit of interest in reading this. And, you know, at that point in my life, almost nobody around me had any inkling what 40K was. You know, nobody knew it in my circle. They were like, what's that? So it was great to get a lot of feedback from them, and they kicked the crap out of it. But they told me why, and that was really important, and I learned a lot from that. And I still do, you know, like, every time I get some feedback from an editor or a test reader, it's phenomenal. It's you have your half hour where you go, ah, you're all fools, how can you not realise the brilliance of this? And then you come back and go, yeah, you know what, you're right. Yeah, that's fair. That's a good comment. Yeah, I'll do that. So, yeah, those two moments of discovering David Gemmell as a writer and feeling that I could have done a better job than this particular author who'd done a thing, was like, yeah, okay, let's do this thing. Let's see, because you know what? I really want to do this, and if I try it and it doesn't work, no harm, no foul. If I don't try it, I'm always going to wonder what might have been. And luckily for me, it's turned out okay.
What was your first work that was published? And do you remember?
Yeah, the first published work I ever had was a Dark Angel short story called Unforgiven that appeared in one of the early issues of Inferno. Because I went down to Mark Gascoigne, who was like the head of Black Library at the time, and I'd written these three stories on spec, and thought, I think they're great, they're brilliant, woohoo! Dropped them off on Mark, and he read them, and he stomped all over them, and, you know, gave me some brutally harsh feedback, which was, again, as a first-time writer of stories, was very hard to hear, but he was absolutely right. You know, his comments and notes in the margin were spot on. I mean, those stories were filled with terrible writing, bad mistakes, and logical errors, and grammar errors, and all the rest of it. And that made me a better writer almost overnight by seeing the traps I'd fallen into, the flaws in my style, the voice that was weak, or whatever. So that was, again, a great learning opportunity and experience, as hard as it was at the time. But yeah, Unforgiven was a cool, you know, it was a cool story about Dark Angels. They were the first chapter I ever owned as models and painted. So, you know, obviously that was going to be my first story, but yeah, it was fun. It was fun, that one.
Okay. Now, okay, this is the end of the world now. This is scenario. And for some odd reason, some greater beings from outer space come down and find you. And they want one thing from you and one thing only. They want you to pick out what you believe is the best piece of literature ever existed, in your opinion, to take with you. What would it be?
Of mine?
Yeah. Well, no. Period. What's your favorite thing that you believe is the best thing ever written?
Now, that is a, you know, like, that's like, you know, I've got, okay, well, what genre? Top fives and all that. So one piece of writing that if I had to take it away, it would probably be David Gemmell's book, Legend, his first novel, which, you know, in the canon of his work, is almost certainly not his best book, but it's got the most heart to it. It's, you know, there's a real sense of a writer emerging in that book, and I love Legend. It's the book I would take with me, you know, when they bury me in my coffin, that's going to be next to me. Yeah.
Mine's also by David Gemmell, but I can't remember the title. A buddy of mine, Derek, lent me the trilogy. It was about the Viking child who went over. And he got traded amongst the different tribes and stuff like that. He thought I'd like it, and I did. Okay. I just like that historical / fiction aspect of it. And like you said, it's not over the top. You're not going to look around and see a 35-foot orc leaning over his shoulder like what movie? Speaking of Vikings and stuff. That Warcraft movie. Okay, anyone who wants to fight an orc, I'm just saying, good on you. Okay, now here's the big thing. Who's your favorite Primarch?
Favorite Primarch? Magnus.
Magnus.
I love writing him. I think he's got such depth to him. I love writing him. He's a great tragic figure. You know, he's the one who tried to do good things. He tried to lift humanity up and to show them all the things that he could see and to know the things that he could know. And sure, he had his hubristic blind spot of arrogance of, you know, I'll do the knowing better for you and I can never be fooled because I'm the smartest man in the room. But, you know, the best characters are the ones with the flaws, the ones with the vulnerabilities, the ones who are undefeatable and the strongest man ever and blah blah blah. They're boring, you know. I like flawed characters. They're you know, and not to bang on about it, but that was David Gemmell's stock and trade. Yep. The wounded, vulnerable, wounded, broken character who still managed to come up and do the right thing or save the day and so on. And you know, in my head canon, Magnus will be the one to save the day in the future. He'll be the one to bring the Imperium back to golden light.
Hear that, Lynn? Probably not going to happen, though. Okay. Now, besides yourself, who do you believe is the best Black Library author?
There's only one crown there, and it's got to be Dan.
Yeah, and he's the reason why I marked it beside yourself, because what was Dan's answer?
Me.
It was me. That's what he said. I was just like, well, you're right. So you started writing off for Black Library, no other publications before that?
Yeah, my first works were for Black Library. I've diversified since then, but yeah, Black Library has been my go-to just because it's a universe that I love. I've been involved in since, you know, Warhammer 3rd Edition, Rogue Trader days. The minute I read the Rogue Trader book, I just fell in love with the imagery, the story, the everything about it just spoke to me on a really visceral level, and I've loved writing stories about it for decades now. I've played the games for years, collected armies, I've worked for the company, I've developed army books and stuff like this. You know, I'm neck deep in this world, and gotcha. I have no intention of climbing out of it.
You know, it's excellent. It's not where you had to build your way to it. You just got to be feet first into
Absolutely.
All right, your least favorite Primarch to write about, if you have to mention him in one of your books, or if they said, okay, Graham, we're sorry to do this, but you have to write about this Primarch.
I don't think I have a least favorite. Every Primarch, if for narrative reasons I had to have them in a book, it's fine, it's good. I will, even if it's not one I know well or have a huge affinity for, I will find the thing that brings that to me, because if you're putting something in your book, it's got to be there for a reason. You know, why am I putting a character I don't care about in my book?
Fictional line dropping.
Yeah, if you're going to put something up, you know, real estate in a book is precious. Readers' time and effort is precious. If you're putting stuff in there that doesn't need to be there or is superfluous, or you obviously don't give a crap about this character, the readers will know. They'll pick up on that, and they'll be like, "Why are you writing this? This is pointless." So, no, I would find my way in to that character, that legion, that faction, or whatever, and find a way to make it these guys cool. I like writing about these guys. If I'm not liking writing about it, the reader's not going to enjoy reading it.
Now, I know the Horus Heresy, it's all around two major people in the end. Now, when you're adding technically the most important, the Emperor, how do you and the other Black Library authors figure out how you're going to incorporate him, and what do you get direction how to have that character represent itself? Do you come about that forward? Because I know if you're writing a book and you got Magnus, he's going to run across the Emperor, just like in Space Wolf, you know, Leman Russ, you know, there's stories with him and stuff. So I think that he's like the pinnacle piece of tacky glue that has to stay in the novels. Is it hard to write that in what you're trying to, when you're trying to represent your own characters?
I mean, the Emperor's always going to be the hardest character to write in the books, because, you know, how do you, I mean, it's hard enough for the Primarchs, but how do you write a character who has been alive for this long, who has this level of vision for the human race, for the species, for the Empire going forward? But by the same time, we've always kind of steered clear of delving too deeply into the Emperor's psyche and mind, because the minute you make the unknowable knowable, it becomes pedestrian, it becomes ordinary, and the minute you make the Emperor ordinary, yeah, you failed. By the same token, though, we are, over the course of when we get to the siege stuff, you will see the Emperor more often, because, you know, you're on Terra, his palace is under siege. And we have to do something with that, because if you don't feel something, whether it's hate or love for the Emperor as a character, when we get to the end in the final showdown, when everything comes down to those two guys, you need that battle, the emotional weight of that battle has to be colossal. You know, this will be the culmination of like 15 years, 16 years of writing. You know, if that battle does not feel suitably epic and emotional, then we failed, you know. So we've put a lot of thought into how we're going to do that, how we're going to build to that, how we're going to portray it, and what's the themes of that. And it's going to be awesome. The stuff that we're thinking about is going to be good. But yeah, we've got to build into that. You know, you've got to lean into it, got to spend the time and the effort to make that thing important before you shatter it in pieces at the end.
Yeah, that will happen. Now, while writing, have you created a character or done something to that character, or multiple, a race or anything? Have you ever cried writing your own literature?
Cried? No. I felt bad about doing things to people and them.
Would you cry if it wasn't your work and you were reading it?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, I there's elements of The Crimson King with how Magnus deteriorates through the course of that book that rang a little too true at some points. But yeah, things like in the Mars trilogy I did, there's one character who has something awful happen to her in it. And even as I was writing it, I felt so bad about doing this, because I loved that character, and I knew that wasn't the end for them. I had plans further on down the line, but that moment was a hard scene to write, because more for the father's reaction to what was happening was awful, because I could put myself right in his head, and the idea of watching that or seeing the result of that was awful, you know. And for those that haven't read those books yet, I'll, you know,
yeah,
not be spoilery, but that was a horrible scene that happened in that book.
I really felt for Fulgrim. I didn't think I'd feel for him, but
Fulgrim not so much, but in the ending of Fulgrim, yeah. when the Empress, the loyalist Empress children are on the ground in Istvan under siege from Sons of Horus and Angron and all the rest of it, there's a scene where Lucius betrays Solomon Demeter and gets him to kill a whole bunch of loyalist Empress children, tricking him into thinking that they're traitors. And when the moment he realizes what he's done breaks him,
Yep.
That was hard to write.
Oh, that whole Esteban. Boy, that just sucked in so many levels. Yeah. The one character, don't know his name, but the Dreadnought, when he watched everything fall and die. Yep, I was just like, I really felt for him. It was like, not only some people think, oh, I'll become a Dreadnought when I'm, you know, when I die and stuff, but that really is a curse that guy had to go through. Now, working on the Horus Heresy project, like you said, it's been 15 years, and I can pretty much safe to say it's not going to end anytime soon, you know, a couple more years. How is that experience working on one project with so many talented people?
It's, you know, without a shadow of a doubt, it's one of the best, most fun, most interesting projects I've ever been involved in, because, you know, I mean, what's not to love about it? You get to work with some of the most talented, creative, wonderful people that I've ever worked with, you know? When we get in the room, it's a bunch of old pals who have, we've worked together on this for 15 years. We know each other very well. We get on very well. There's a great atmosphere of trust and respect. And it's fun, you know?
Yeah.
The minute this wasn't fun, we probably wouldn't be doing it.
And that's like my tagline is, if you're not having fun, stop playing the game.
Yeah.
And then exactly. You got to have fun.
I mean, like I said before, if you're not enjoying the thing, that will translate into the words. It's great fun, you know, because there's, you know, I geek out every time I start working on a project like this. Because like I say, I've been playing this for decades,
yep.
You know.
And this is something that's just like, you know, it's there. That's the setting of the universe, but no one's ever explored it.
I remember, age 15 in my mother and father's back room, me and my mates playing Epic, the system game. Yeah, and we're looking through the codexes, and it's the story of Leman Russ and the Blood Angels and all the, you know, the, we did a rough scenario on Siege of the Emperor's Palace sort of thing. And I remember, you know, if I could look back to 15-year-old me and tell him, do you know what? In a couple of decades, you're going to be writing this. You know, hopefully you're going to be inspiring people the same way that the books you have in your hand right now are inspiring you. Like the second edition codexes and the stories in there, you know, like Bill King wrote a lot of them, Andy Chambers, and some of them Gav Thorpe as well. You know, I was colossally inspired by those stories. I breathed 40K when I was that age. You know, I still do, but it was just my hobby then. Now it's everything, you know. So I love the fact that I can still picture this in that back room, loving the stories about this, being inspired by what I was reading, and to know that this is what I do for a living now is awesome.
Well, I got three more questions. Everyone could just call it. First of all, what character in the 40K or fantasy universe you wish you could write about? That you haven't wrote about yet?
I don't know. There's not many, because like in the course of a, you know, like 18-year career workshop, I've pretty much written most things. The ones that got away, one is in fantasy. I did a wood elf novel, and then did a duology of high elf novels. And I wanted to get back. I wanted to do a dark elf novel, so I could sort of complete the hat trick. And I didn't get the chance to do that, you know, through, you know, my own dabbling in other genres and so on. 40K, and it may still happen, but I want to write the Battle for Macragge, the first Tyrannic invasion.
Okay.
I would love to write that story.
More so on the Space Marine side of it and what to experience.
Yeah, you know, because it's got some.
It's hard to write on the bugs side.
Side of things. It's the iconic. It's one of the most iconic battles of the 41st millennium. You know, the death of the first company, the third and the seventh coming back to Macragge, Crippman's first discovery of the Nids, and so on. It's got so many awesome beats to it that I would love to tell that story. Heresy, I've pretty much touched all the ones I really want to touch. You know, there's nothing I feel, God damn it, I haven't quite gotten to do that yet. You know, we'll see by the end. You know, by the end there might be stuff that'll come out and go, yeah, I wish I'd done more than that. But
yeah.
At the moment, I have no regrets.
In the Horus Heresy novels, how do you feel Because it shocked me when I read it, to find out how the Primarchs were created and how they were sent off on different planets and the reasoning why and everything like that. How does that gel with you as a writer, and that's how you got to deal with it?
I was in the room when we talked about that. So
did you thought it was silly at first? Or?
I mean, a lot of the ideas, you know, when they're first mooted, until you unpack them, it's hard sometimes to go, yeah, that is stupid, or no, that's awesome actually. And there's plenty of ideas that have come up in the room where we've looked at them and gone, really, that's where you're going with this? And then the more we talk about it, the more we work out the repercussions of that, the roads that lead to and from that moment, some people go, actually, you know what, that makes sense, and on a lot of levels that's really clever and what have you. So yeah, I you know, we talked about that one, and we came up with the rationale for why it happened, the way it could be perceived to be happened, different explanations as why it, what the reasoning behind it might have been, and all of them could be valid. And that was the key thing for that one, that we didn't, a lot of the times we don't ever want to nail something definitively to the mast. You know, we don't want to get into the realm of unreliable narrator for everything, so you can't trust anything you read. But some things should, you know, Yojimbo, like, have that level of, or Rashomon, have that level of the same event viewed from different perspectives will color what you think happened.
And it reminds me of the Child of Krypton story for each of the Primarchs.
Yeah.
So they're like, coming. Very much so. All right, now on my last question. I've interviewed quite a bit, I haven't done it lately, and there's three authors that they were like, oh, how do you interview a person like that because they look like they're scary? You're on that list. Number two, James Swallow. Third, Aaron Dembski Bolden. What do you got to say to the people that might be afraid to approach you? Because I know a lot of people are, you know, they're fanboys. They're, you know, they like that, you know, meeting their hero, writing anything. I mean, my first Black Library author I met was Dan Abnett. And literally, I sat behind the table with him all day at Games Day. I had a carry-on luggage with the wheels and everything, full of his novels, even stuff that he didn't have because it was so old. And so that's super fanboy. Now, I've gone past somebody because I felt intimidated. And I don't think anyone should feel intimidated by anybody, especially you. But you're not, I'm not saying where you are on the list, but you're not one in three. So you're somewhere in the middle. So what do you got to say to those people?
Don't be silly, you know. Come and talk to me. You know, like, I love talking about space wizards and goblins and geeking out over this stuff, because I'm a player. I'm a consumer of this hobby. I paint toy soldiers. I play my toy soldiers. I write about toy soldiers. I love talking about this sort of stuff. So if you see me at an event or anywhere, just come and talk to me. Say hi. We are not scary. We do not bite. Jim and Aaron, likewise, they are not scary. They are lovely guys.
Oh, Jim, I haven't met Aaron yet, but Jim, I was like, oh, you know, because you only see somebody like on the pictures.
Yeah,
here.
You see their intimidating blue steel picture, you know,
or someone wielding an axe from an awardee guy. But Jim, I found, I was just like a very talkative teddy bear.
He's a lovely, just like, lovely man. Yeah, I've got a lot of time for both Jim and Aaron. You know, they're lovely, warm, wonderful human beings. You know, and everybody should spend some time talking to them.
I lied about the last question, but is there any book, your newest book, you want to plug for the audience?
Well, my latest one that's out at the moment for Black Library is The Crimson King, which is the follow-up to A Thousand Suns. So if you enjoyed that book, I would urge you to pick up this one to see how the story of the Suns continues. As far as ongoing or current work, I've yet to, you know, finalize, you know, next projects and stuff like that, but I'm likely next to take up a story of the Shattered Legion crew of the Sisypheum, the guys from the Seventh Serpent and Angel Exterminatus. So that's likely to be my next project.
Okay.
Well, I'd like to thank you for taking the
that
time.
That was my,
and,
I guess, my attempt at
finally
meet
you. We've had an interview a couple years ago, and for those who, I've had people say they listened to it, they thought we were in the same room. We actually were. Yeah, we are today, not during that last interview, but today we are.
No, absolutely.
Crazy
Cat,
50 Souls. That's what I call this one. Okay, running in here, we have Caitlin Abernathy. She's our Hamlin proxy, basically, for upgrades. I gave her Sewer King and the Plague and Tools of the Tyrant. Now, which is pretty cool, is when I go through the abilities on the figure on this Malifaux app, any of the upgrades will add that to the actual, I don't know, the digital representation. So she's a Tyrant. She's Nihilist with Cash 1. That blows. Defense 5, 7 willpower, 12 wounds, 5 walk, 6 charge, height 2. She's got Ferocious Rats, meaning that if an enemy model or a model with the blighted condition within 6 inches of one or more friendly models, friendly models with this ability is killed, summon a Malifaux Rat in the base contact. And we're going to be calling them Alicats. She's got Nihilism, which means that when she gains a condition, you choose not to gain it instead, if you like. She's got Lure of Emptiness. If this model is killed or sacrificed, it may sacrifice a friendly the stolen within 3 inches instead. If this happens, the model is not killed or sacrificed and heals 4 damage. So she's got some staying power. She got Infiltration, Lost. Crews led by this model may hire up to 4 Lost models that are not the crew's declared faction. Yeah, good luck with that one. I find it easy, really, with her that she just buy a whole bunch of stuff that's in her faction anyway. She's got Virulent. The blighted condition may not be removed from models within 6-inch aura. Like I said, that could be one of her her upgrades. She's got Faced Inevitable. Enemy models within 6-inch aura of this model, which declare interact action, must discard a card or the action immediately fails. That's pretty cool. For attack action, she has the Black Staff, which is 1, 2, 4 damage, range of 1, with a trigger on a crow, a trigger on a crow, and a ram. So 1 is Black Death. After damaging, target suffers equal damage to its blighted condition of 3. Taint. After damaging, the target gains the following condition. To the number of times you have Crow in the final duel, Blighted plus 1. And Unhealthy Pallor with the Ram. After succeeding, this model heals 1 damage for each model within 3-inch pulse with the Blighted condition. And that can be pretty damn good. And Contagious Touch with the Double Crow. After damaging an enemy model within 3 inches in line of sight of the target, gains the following condition, Blighted 1. At the end of the turn, increase this condition by value 1. So, it's what she's got to work with, man. So we'll go with it. She got Pipes. This is a range attack for 14 range with a gun. Target must, so when you shoot it, move target model, its walk. The target must end its move as close to this model as possible. If the target has a blighted condition, it may be moved its charge instead of walk. So it's kind of like a lure. Haunting with a crow, which is built in, 1, 2, 3 damage. Decaying with the crow, which is built in, gets plus 1 blighted. And with the crow, all of these are crow, so you can take your choice which one you feel like doing. Sick in bed. After succeeding against a target with a blighted condition, value 4 or greater, the target gains the following condition to the end of the game. Sick in bed. This model must discard 2 cards when declaring an interact action or the action fails. That's pretty good. This is kind of like where I like, she's got this, and so the Schrodinger's cat. But bleeding disease. Range 12, target suffers amount of damage equal to the value of its blighted condition. And you're going to want to be adding that blighted condition to everything you have. This one here just stops you from actually having to worry about summoning a Malifaux, a child, or stolen, or her ones that they're named proxies. But you can summon 1 the stolen base contact with this model and then sacrifice all friendly non the stolen totems. So she can have a couple in her crew, so it's all cool. If she throws a mask and a tome of that, you have to blow some stones. Mesmerize once per turn, after succeeding, takes this action again. The citizen of the stolen are pretty essential for her staying alive. And plus they got some neat little tricks we'll see with the rats and or the cats and everything. Useless toy. sacrifice target model within 6 to draw 2 cards. If the sacrifice model is the stolen, all enemy models win 3-inch pulse of it receive the following condition. Blighted plus 1. Yeah, so blowing up little freaking... I don't know. Like it. I like it. Let's see. Useless choice. Infiltration comes from Sewer King. The Plague. Chivalrant. The King. Second bag come off of the Plague. Trade. Tools of the Tyrant. It comes with Unhealthy Paler. Face Inevitable. Okay. So, like I said, they're added into it. Let's see. She's got... go and kill that. And a totem. Okay. Her Allure-maniac. Allure-maniac? I don't know. If you know it, how to pronounce it, I'm bad. But this is her PN Lost models that she can summon. They are diseased. And they begin their activation with three... Enemy models that begin with a 3-inch aura of this model gain the following condition. Blighted plus 1. They're sickly. This model counts as having a blighted condition when it is killed. So, yeah, she can pop up some rats when she dies. Horrible realization. When this model is killed or sacrificed, all enemy models within 3-inch aura must pass the target number 11 willpower duel or gain paralyzed. Because you just killed a little kid, man. They're insignificant. Useless fling for their attacks at 114. Bleeding disease that allows you to hand out damage equal to its blighted condition. And she has an inevitable fate. Two action, summon two Malifaux rats in base contact with this model, then sacrifice this model. So, we're looking at that. At Caitlin here, she can summon one of these. She didn't stone to do it again, so she can do two. She technically can make each one of those take their two action to sacrifice themselves for two rats. Okay, inevitable fate. Then sacrifice this model, and let me see, before I go horrible, when this model is killed, or sacrificed, yeah, so she can get cats, forcing willpower duels, paralyze people, and this is free for, technically speaking, I think it's 2, 4, 6, 8 points, that she'll get just have one summon, and one soulstone, if she wishes to do it, so, yeah, I like it. Next up, we have her henchman, which is Schrodinger Cat. He's got the hollow upgrade. It's released to hounds. We're not really worried about that. Allows you to lead a crew of any dogs. But it will give him draw a contagion. This model may take a 2 charge action as a 1 if the model is affected by the blighted condition, which it should be. And hollow. Into the start of your next model's activation, friendly models within 5-inch aura are immune to damage dealt by pulse blasts and aura effects. So pretty nice. But the cat himself, he's pretty sexy. Defense 5, 6 willpower, 6 wounds, 5 walk, 7 charge, height 2. This guy here has the sweet taste of failure. When an enemy model within 3-inch aura fails a duel, this model heals 1 damage. It's got weakness. If an enemy model within 3 inches would deal severe damage, it deals moderate instead. Nihilism. He's not going to gain anything if he doesn't want it. He's got incorporeal, so he can ignore half damage and stuff and go through. He's a ghost. He's a specter. Release the hounds. I already did that and drawn the contagion. His attack actions are feed on anima. It's a 2-3-4 damage. And targeted gets a plus 1 blate. At the end of the turn, you can increase its value by 1. So he's handing out some more blighted. Bleeding disease. That's when you're handing out damage based on how much poison they have. Drink Spirit, models with a Nihilist characteristics within 4-inch aura of this model must pass the target. Models without the Nihilist characteristics, within 4-inch pulse of this model must pass a target number 15 weapon power duel or gain the following condition to the end of the game. Guess what it is? Blighted. and that was Drink Spirit. Plague Pit. Until the end of the turn, enemy models within 6-inch aura with blighted condition value 4 or higher may not take interact actions. Pretty handy. And, like I said, Hollow is on there too. So, initially I liked playing No, or starting a Hamlin crew. I have a completely metal Hamlin crew I'll probably give away too. I'm going to give away my Hamlin crew. And they're all on sewer bases. They're metal. I started painting them. Send me a reason. Email Sean Hammer, the number 9, why you need this Hamlin crew. And I'll send them your way free of charge. So, unless you're over in Australia or something, I'll make you pay shipping. But because that's expensive, but I'll give them out free. I can't see not using them. Can't see throwing away. I'd like to give them to somebody who will at least appreciate them. Alright, next up we have the Dutiful Son, which is going to be the other version of the Obedient Wretch. 5 defense, 5 willpower, 5 wounds, 4 walk, no charge, height 2. This guy here sees diseased. Enemy models that begin their activation within 3 inches of this model gain the following condition to the end of the game. Blighted plus 1. He's sickly. This model counts as having a blighted condition when killed. And horrible realization. When this model is killed or sacrificed, so it's given a chance when he dies, you might get poisoned. I mean, paralyzed. I like this. Toss threat. Shooting 5. Range 6. Target suffers 1, 2, 4 damage. With a crow trigger, so you gotta have a crow. Think of death after damaging and determining whether the target was killed. If the target is still in play, summon a Malifaux Rat in the base contact with a target, so it'll be a alley cat in this instance. So, I like it. I mean, you got, they're outcasts too. You can give this guy, I think, Oathkeeper, make him fast, throw 3 rats, move one up, bam, now you got a cat king in their face. All for the lovely cost of, let's see, 1 soulstone for the Oathkeeper. And, yeah. Off the lovely cost of not a lot. And he's got the bleeding disease like everyone else, wondering he can give you damage. And he's inevitable fate too. You summon 2 Malifaux Rats in base contact, then sacrifice this model. Okay, now we're gonna go ahead and what to do here. I'll do the rat catcher first, which will in terms be the cat catcher. Minion living rare 2 Nihilist. 5 defense, 5 willpower, 8 wounds, 5 walk, 6 charge, height 2. This guy has the ferocious rats. Enemy models or models with a blighted condition, a 6-inch aura or more is killed. Basically, if an enemy model or a model with a blighted condition within 6 inches of one or more friendly models with this ability is killed, summon a Malifaux Rat in the base contact before it's removed from play. These guys have cover with the rats, but cover with cats. This model gains the following condition for each Malifaux Rat in base contact with it. Armor plus 1. Reduce all damage suffered by this model to a minimum of 1. Quite literally, you can have a couple cats on his ass. And he'll get armor 3 or 4. It's sick. I know. It's silly. But it is. He's got 1 attack action. He's got quite a few triggers. All triggering off the built-in crow that he has. He's got Rusty Trap. Target suffers 1, 2, 3 damage. Gains the following condition in the turn. Blighted. Now, clearing your triggers, catch and release. Once per turn after succeeding against an enemy, summon a Malifaux Rat in the base contact with the target. Attack. Once per turn with this guy. Free cat. Okay. Quarantine. After succeeding against a model which had a blighted condition of 3 or greater, before applying the result of this action, target suffers plus 2 damage. So essentially it is 3, 4, 5 damage if they're added to it. And Rust is shut. After succeeding, target gains a slow condition. Not bad. Tactical actions, he's got 2. Moldy cheese, target vermin within 6 inches, reactivate. This action can only be taken once per turn. This action gains a plus 4 cast when targeting Malifaux Rats. So, yeah. And he's got Routing Odor. Place any number of friendly Malifaux Rats within 5 inches in line of sight into base contact with this model. Now, that right there, it's going to boost up his armor. And as you will see in a minute here, It's going to boost up his armor, make the cats easier to go into Rat King where they're a significant bigger model. I mean, the possibilities aren't endless, but they're pretty useful. Okay, next up, we have the cats. Unfortunately, these guys are peons for two soulstones. Defense 4, 4 willpower, 3 wounds, walk 5, no charge, but height 1. 30mm basis, they have the tinkled ability. At the beginning of this model's activation, if there are 3 or more other Malifaux rats within 3 inches of this model, including enemy models, summon the Rat King model in the base contact with this model, then sacrifice this model and all Malifaux rats within 3 inches of this model. So if you're unfortunate enough to play against another Hamelin crew, your ship becomes his, his ship becomes yours. It's pretty cool. You get the Cat King out of it. Now, buying a Cat King is going to cost the same amount as buying 4 alley cats, so you're better off just trying to do some of the tricks that you can do with the Rat King and the cats, and the free rats you get from other models around. These guys are insignificant. They got Plagueborn, cannot gain the bladed condition. They're puny, can't make disengaging strikes, and they're Hamelin's pets. This model may only be hired by crews led by the Nihilist. If this is model summoned into a crew which was not led by a Nihilist, it may not activate on the turn it was summoned. Okay. It's got one attack action. Yellow Teeth. Okay, built-in crow, 1 trigger, 2. 001 damage. Damage gains following to the end of the game. Blighted, plus 1. Okay. At the end of the turn, increase, okay. Increase the value of the blighted to plus 2 if moderate damage is flipped or cheated, and plus 3 if severe or is flipped or cheated. So he's going to add a little bit more blighted with an actual attack, and he's got Swarm. First trigger, immediately increase the final duel by plus 1 for each other friendly Malifaux rat within 1 inch of the target. Yeah, I mean, these guys are going to be little pains in the asses, and they're so cute. I don't know really what to tell you. I mean, they're just adorable. Let's see, let's find this Rat King. He's a minion. Do-do-do-do-do. Great podcasting, right? Okay, the Rat King. And this is where it's at. It's kind of hard to collect, well, for one, this crew. Because you got to buy the encounter box, so you get the Rat Kings, and you get more rats, and you get the Rat Catchers. But a Rat King is a Vermin Swarm. Minion, Soulstone 8. Or, you know, made. Now, what's great is if you can playing against another Hamelin character, and they got 3 rats, and you can get right into their activations, your turn to flip, you can create the Rat King to be your own, using his rats to create your Cat King. I mean, that's some little downright dirty shit right there, but oh well. Abilities is Boar. When this model ends its move in the base contact with an enemy model, the enemy model must immediately pass the target number 12 walk duel or gain slow. These guys drawn to contagion, this model takes the and can charge 1 action if you get blighted. Into the Swarm. At the beginning of this model's activation, it may sacrifice all Malifaux rats within 3 inches, including enemy models. Then this model heals 1 damage for each model sacrificed that way. Like I say, dirty pool if you're playing against another Hamelin crew. And which would be funny if you're playing the Caitlin Abernathy and her cats. The cats eat the rat. Anyway, you get it, right? Plagueborn. Can't get the blighted condition. Attack action, Swarm of Yellow Teeth, 2, 3, 4 damage, it does the same thing. Blighted 1, if this model has 4 more wounds, remaining this attack gets plus 2 to the attack flip. Spray Filth, after killing a target enemy model, all models win 6 inch pulse, of the following gain the following condition in the turn, blighted. And Overwhelm, after damaging, you need a tome on this one. After damaging, take this action again against the same target. This attack suffers negative 1 melee. This trigger may only be declared if the attack which was triggered is of melee 2 or higher. So if you keep popping tomes in there, that's telling you until you hit a minimum of a melee thing, you can do it a couple times. Tactical actions. 1. Rat problem. Sacrifice this model and all Malifaux rats within 3 inches of this model, including enemy models, and summon a rat catcher and a Malifaux rat in base contact with this model before removing it. Like I say, a bunch of bullcrap stuff you can do right there. If you're playing against somebody playing Malifaux Rats, take tier stuff. They know it. They gotta know it. But also, they got Gnaw. Target a scheme marker within 5 inches. Place this model in base contact with the marker and discard it. This action may not be taken while this model is engaged. So, get rid of your scheme markers out there. That's about it. I know there's one guy that came out in the Broken Promises. I don't know if I'm actually going to get him, just because, unless they do a cat version. I mean, he's got rats all over him. He goes to it. I know for gameplay purposes, they have to put Malifaux Rats on there because you get people arguing, like, mine says cats and yours says rats, so it's completely different, and I get it. But I did get cards with all these. Some of them had different names on the cards. It's a beautiful-looking army. And the storyline encounter thing, kind of quirky, I guess. I guess it was better than the Dark Carnival one I did. I didn't do the McCabe one last year. And I'm going to leave you guys with that interview. Look for the auction coming up. I'll post that up there. Check on my Facebook page. You got any questions, concerns, comments, bitches, gripes you want me to know, send them to Sean Hammer, the number 9@yahoo.com. Also, don't forget, you can win a Lazarus by just telling me what you liked about the podcast, today's episode. Constructive feedback, that's what I'm looking for. Best feedback, get to Lazarus. And if you need a Hamlin Crew medal, tell me why you need it. Make it good. And I'll be giving that out as well. And I'm going to leave you with that. A little music at the end. And hope you enjoyed. And remember, if you're not having fun, stop playing the game.
Du hast mich. Du hast mich. Du hast mich. Du hast mich. Ich hab nichts gesagt. Willst du bist